The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Hi, everybody. If you search for the topic of Marxism and Native Americans, at the top of the list you will find a book of essays with that very title, edited by Ward Churchill in the 1980s. Churchill's goal of encouraging a friendly intellectual exchange between Native activists and organized revolutionary Marxists was never accomplished, though. This was because the politics of the left here in the United States and internationally was dominated in the 60s and 70s and 80s by Maoism and Stalinism, or populism or social democracy or some combination. Trotskyist organizations, including the ISOs at the time, were still very small, comparable to these other groups. And Maoism and Stalinism are Marxist in name only. Their political framework of socialism from above failed the test of understanding that national oppression, economic exploitation, and social oppression are inextricably linked. All must be taken up together in movements from below if we are ever going to achieve a workers' revolution in this country. So our starting point as Marxists should be that the oppression of Native Americans and their corresponding resistance of 500 years is shaped by the dispossession of indigenous lands and resources. The U.S. was founded as a colonial settler project and built on the bodies of enslaved blacks, the dispossession of indigenous lands and genocide, and the exploitation of laborers, men, women, Native, black, immigrant alike. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz describes these dynamics in her book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States. Quote, everything in U.S. history is about the land. Who oversaw it and cultivated it, fished its waters, maintained its wildlife, who invaded and stole it, how it became a commodity, real estate, broken into pieces to be bought and sold on the market, end quote. There are over 500 indigenous nations in the United States. They have legal possession of about 2.6% of lands, which were all formerly theirs. These 60 million acres of reservation lands remain in government trust. According to the 2010 census, 5.2 million people in the United States identified as American Indian and Alaskan Native, either alone or in combination with one or more other races. Out of this total, 2.9 million people identified as American Indian and Alaskan Native alone. So today I'm going to be covering these points. One, what are the key arguments and debates in Churchill's book on Marxism and Native Americans, and why did the contributors get it so wrong? Is Marxism Eurocentric? Secondly, what have self-proclaimed Marxists or people influenced by Marxism argued on this question of indigenous liberation? And thirdly, I'll end on some concrete ways we can fight for Native American self-determination today. Am I reading too fast? Okay. So starting with Ward Churchill, the American Indian Movement activist and author, was operating in a left coming out of a tremendous struggle of the 1960s and 70s. Movements had advanced and won gains for women, blacks, natives, and indigenous peoples, lesbian and gays. And out of these struggles, sections of the working class regained confidence to organize actions at the workplace. There were waves of wildcat strikes, including natives in mining and extraction industries. But by the early 80s, the majority of the movements were receding as the ruling class went on the offensive. There was a concerted pushback against these gains of these struggles, and neoliberalism came to be the model for rebuilding the U.S. economy after the economic recession in the 1970s. In times of economic crisis and boom, natives have always faced new waves of land and resource-based attacks. Nations see increased attacks on their cultural rights, communities and families, and national self-determination. U.S. capitalism needs materials and cheap energy to rebuild profits and growth. And in the 1970s, there was an oil boom that was similar to what we've seen this last decade with the fracking boom. And because of this, there was a growing movement of environmental battles with indigenous nations and peoples at the heart of these struggles. And similar to today, it was the movements themselves that were posing the question, what does Marxism offer the struggle for Native liberation and oppressed peoples? It was not only about the gains we could achieve in the moment, but ultimately how a socialist society would be built. How would we democratically use natural resources and produce what we needed to live together in harmony with people and the earth? And within this, how would the left answer the question of self-determination and national liberation for indigenous peoples? Churchill laid out in the book that land was a key feature in this. Quote, there can be no question that the entirety of the continental United States has been expropriated from its original indigenous inhabitants, with incalculably harmful consequences accruing to them in the process. From a moral perspective, it should be equally clear that no human solution to the overall issues confronting any American radical can reasonably be said to exist should it exclude mechanisms through which to safeguard the residual land base and cultural identities of these people, end quote. So Winona LaDuc, who is a member of the White Earth Nation and an environmental activist and author, wrote the best section of the book. She essentially asked if there is an eco-socialist answer to the fight for native liberation and the ecological devastation being wrought by capitalism on both people and the land. Colonization, as LaDuc said, was a history of constant exploitation of the earth. Quote, we would argue that Marx was correct, that not only the expropriation and its immediate social aftermath are important, rather the permanent society, which not only emerges, but which is possible under such circumstances, must be brought into serious consideration, unquote. So in her essay, LaDuc lays out how rising class inequality at the time created the material conditions for potential solidarity, that natives and non-natives alike should care about the growing destruction of the earth. LaDuc was also the clearest on the questions that were posed in the book and seemed the most open, in my mind, to what Marxism has to offer as a theory to aid native struggles. She said, without denying that Marxism is or can be a unifying system, it steps outside the Marxist paradigm to ask new questions. What is Marxism's understanding of the land? What will be the relationship of a Marxist society to the land? Is Marxism as it is now structured or could be structured a part of the solution or a part of the problem? And finally, is it or what is appropriate to North America? End quote. But these questions go unanswered in this compilation of essays. Instead, what is frustratingly laid out in those 200 pages only furthers an argument that we still hear today that Marxism is Eurocentric. Here's a taste of some of the incredibly backward dogmatic ideas put forward by the Revolutionary Communist Party, supposed Marxist-Leninists, and other self-identified socialists that feel the idea that Marxism is just part of a European tradition that must be rejected by natives. In a chapter titled Searching for a Second Harvest, the RCP, there was no single author at the time. Maybe it was Bob Bacon, I'm not sure, responded to the American Socialist Movement leader, Russell Means, this way, a drift of racism and reactionary ideas. Quote, Means is reluctant to cite this particular pre-tribal period as part of the, quote, traditional ways he claims to want to return to. Anyone who depended on the mammoth for food today would be in big trouble. Perhaps Means would like to be transported back some 7,000 years to the desert bands of the Great Basin of Nevada and western Utah to live in the ways of the, quote, ancestors of that period. Other primitive people were known to have saved their feces so that in time of famine they could extract the undigested seeds and other products for food, end quote. So this is what the RCP meant as a second harvest. Basically, they argued that native peoples wanted to return to a time where they were supposedly forced to eat shit. So after calling Russell Means a noble savage and backwards many times in the book, the RCP admits that the way indigenous peoples organized themselves prior to colonialism was superior to what we have now. But the RCP lays out a stagist approach, a determinist view of economic and social change, where every country must go through the same stages of economic development. The RCP glorifies the progress of capitalism, and they fall into the trap of arguing that we need to further industrialize for socialism to flourish. While claiming Marxism, the authors argue that it was the natural order that native cultures are dying because capitalism is a force that you cannot stop. Therefore, Means responds that the so-called theories of Marxism and anarchism and leftism in general cannot be separated from the rest of European intellectual tradition. It's really the same old song, he says. Means argued that Marxists only think natives need to industrialize, to be turned into proletarians, and how Marx himself thought of Indians as pre-capitalists and primitive. He argues we have always been economically backward in Marxist terms. So is Marxism Eurocentric? First off, I want to say that Marx didn't get it all right in one swell swoop, but that instead Marxism provides a method and a political understanding of both how capitalism works and how we need the self-activity of workers and the oppressed to change society, to end exploitation and class society, to fully realize democratic rights, human potential, and the ability to end oppression. Marx's ideas changed throughout his life. He got some things right and some things wrong, and his knowledge was sometimes limited, especially about what was taking place in other continents. And his ideas reflected certain prejudices and racism that was dominant of the time he organized. But on the word primitive, referred to by means, Marx didn't mean to be derogatory. He was simply describing the period or societies before capitalism came fully into being. The process of primitive accumulation, as Marx argued in Capital Volume 1, was a violent and coercive process of divorcing the direct producers from their means of production, the land, and forcing them to sell their labor for wages in order to survive. I mentioned LeDuc referring to these ideas by Marx before. Primitive accumulation was the prehistory of capitalist mode of production. It was the primary accumulation, an accumulation which is not the result of the capitalist mode of production, but its point of departure, as Marx said. So I believe native oppression is intimately tied to the development of capitalism. Capitalism is about concentrating resources and wealth into fewer and fewer hands, the turning of communal property into private property. And this basis, and this formed the basis of massive wealth and capitalist development, and further created the social basis of the contending classes, and further oppressing indigenous peoples who were and continue to face expropriation, exploitation, and dispossession. Marx's historical materialist method, I think, is key to understanding the history that the US, of the history of the United States linking land, slavery, and labor. At the end of his life, Marx studied pre-capitalist societies and championed the struggle of oppressed nations against colonialism and imperialism, and he changed his views based on those struggles against colonialism. But it doesn't end with what Marx wrote 150 years ago. As Pranav Jani recently argued in a piece in Socialist Worker on Marx in India, quote, Marx is hugely important for understanding capitalism as a system rooted in slavery, colonialism, and racism. Marxists have made major contributions to developing that understanding after imperialism took full-fledged form after Marx's death in 1883. The truths of Marxism aren't simply in a book. Marxism isn't and shouldn't be turned into a prophet, and Marxism isn't and shouldn't be turned into a dogma. End quote. But this is exactly what Maoism and Stalinism did. Maoism and Stalinism turned Marxism on its head. The RCP followed the lead set by Joseph Stalin as a new class bureaucracy crushed the workers' government that came to power in Russia. Following the successful workers' and peasant revolution in Russia in 1917, the revolution did not spread to other countries, and Russia was left isolated and economically destroyed. The choice was made, either remain loyal to the theory and goal of international proletarian revolution with the possibility of losing state power in Russia, or cling to power and abandon the theory. Trotskyism was the first choice, who represented the left opposition, and Stalinism was the second. Stalin won out, and he revised and distorted the politics of international socialism to socialism in one country to fit the needs of a growing bureaucracy and a new ruling class above workers and peasants. So socialism in one country meant state capitalism, the Soviet Union, USSR, and it developed massive industrial capacity to compete with other countries and use the working class to extract surplus labor. And this is what we refer to as socialism from above. So Mises and others rightfully put so-called Marxist-Leninists on the spot and asked them, what socialism means when you see what supposedly socialist countries are doing in terms of indigenous liberation and the destruction of the planet. Mises argued, in order for us to really join forces with Marxism, we Indians would have to accept the national sacrifice of our homeland. I look to the process of industrialization in the Soviet Union since the 1920s, and I see that these Marxists have done what it took the English Industrial Revolution 300 years to do, and the Marxists did it in 60 years. I see that the territory of the USSR used to contain a number of tribal peoples, and that they have been crushed to make way for the factories. I look to China and I see the same thing. I look to Vietnam and I see the Marxists imposing industrial order and rooting out the indigenous tribal mountain people. And I see the Vietnamese taking over a nuclear power plant abandoned by the US and China exploding nuclear bombs, end quote. So the dominance of the Soviet Union did not make Native activists interested in Marxism. The left was largely absent in these movements fighting for indigenous rights and mainly critiqued them from the outside. So it is important to put some of these problematic comments by Russell Means and Ward Churchill in this context. And some of them are really problematic if you read it. Means talked about the fact that he didn't want to write because it is European, or he inferred that maybe the old order has to kind of die, and people included, for real change to come about. So it was a really problematic debate that took place in that book. But there wasn't a principle left to gravitate towards that actually took on Native liberation seriously. Therefore, it made sense that some of these Native activists longed for the past that was destroyed by settler colonialism and capitalism. But luckily, this book by Churchill isn't the only voice we have for understanding what Marxism offers the struggle for Native liberation. So on this, I'm going to go to what some self-proclaimed Marxists or people influenced by Marxism have argued on this question. In 1928, Peruvian socialist José Carlos Mariátegui argued in his 7 interpretive essays on Peruvian reality, quote, "For those of us who study and identify the problem of the Indian from a socialist point of view, we assume the least romantic and literary position possible by identifying it primarily as a socioeconomic problem. We are not content with demanding the Indian's right to education, culture, progress, love, and heaven. We start by categorically demanding the right to land. And this problem of the land, whose solidarity with the problem of the Indian is overtly evident, does not allow us to mitigate or diminish it opportunistically," end quote. So Lance Selfa recently helped bring Mariátegui's work to the left's attention in an article in the International Socialist Review. And Selfa described how Mariátegui's ideas were shaped by using Marxism as a method to understand both the concrete reality in Peru and the struggles of workers and the oppressed against those conditions. Mariátegui's writing can help us understand that the relationship between the working class, the peasantry, and other aspects of class formation in the developing world, as well as the relationship between race and class, in particular as it relates to the struggles of indigenous people, and then also the relationship between the fight for socialism and against imperialism. So on Mariátegui, his politics were influenced by the rapidly changing conditions in Peru. 80% of the population was indigenous in the early 20th century in Peru. Now that total is closer to 50%. Many natives had long participated in wage and agrarian labor. They were peasants, miners, and workers in urban areas. And between 1912 and 1918, waves of strikes took place to demand the 8-hour day in Peru, and student movements erupted. World War II accelerated urbanization and proletarianization. And previously, Peru had regained some of its feudal components due to the history of Spanish colonialism. But in the 1920s, struggles and rural uprisings of Peru's indigenous people asserted their rights, and there were periods where indigenous peasants expelled large landowners. And these struggles culminated into the first national Indian congresses since the Peruvian Republic was formed in 1824, and one of these, Mariátegui, was able to attend and make some links to the indigenous activists. These conditions in Peru and huge upheavals of resistance allowed Mariátegui to see how solidarity and class consciousness amongst all workers can only develop if racism is taken up. Racism against indigenous people, blacks, descendants of former slaves, and Chinese workers imported to coastal plantations. Mariátegui argued that the fight against racism was essential for workers and socialist movement to develop. And starting with the social economic demands of indigenous land rights and also taking up the need to fight racism, Mariátegui is also able to draw a vital thread to the demands of the indigenous working class being connected to workers as a whole in Peru, including white and mestizo workers. From this, Mariátegui formulated how socialist ideas could develop amongst the indigenous working class and peasants. Class-conscious indigenous workers could help connect to the wider indigenous struggles as they actually traveled back and forth between urban jobs and working in mines and going back to peasant indigenous communities. Mariátegui's writing is unwavering, I think, in his argument that it is capitalism that has caused indigenous poverty and how this is rooted in dispossession and connected to the land. There can be no liberation at all, no real Peru, he argues, unless the liberation and self-determination of Native peoples is upheld and fought for by all workers and the oppressed. So I start with Mariátegui in the section to help illustrate how we can't limit Marxist contributions to indigenous liberation and issues of land sovereignty to just North America. We lose much insight if we were to do this. In Latin America, countries, in Latin American countries, Peru, Bolivia, and many others, they have a larger indigenous population, and this has actually caused them to link the question of indigenous liberation to workers' struggles. Indigenous peoples experience land expropriation and termination here differently than in Peru, Bolivia, Colombia, and others. Thank you, perfect. The US and Canada share a history of being founded as colonial settler projects. Both countries were established through brutal removal and attempted annihilation of the indigenous population, with the end goal of stealing the whole landmass as the major force of capitalist development, wealth, and power. And Canada has a similar indigenous population as the United States. First Nations people, Métis, and Inuit are roughly 5% of the population, and they are the fastest growing group in Canada. If you go further north, some comrades were talking about, it's like 80% of the population outside of the main centers. So today, over 78% of natives here in the United States live off of reservation. 72% live in cities or suburban areas. And in Canada, 55% live off reserve. So I want to move to a contribution of Howard Adams. He was an author of a book called Canada from a Native, it was called Prison of Grass, Canada from a Native Point of View. And his experience is much closer to ours. And his political contribution, I think, is very important because of this. Also, Adams is unlike some scholars in the US and Canada who have started using Marxism to look at the history of treaties and land rights and so on, but they actually don't extend it to the question of land, labor, and class. So Adams was a leader of the Red Power movement in Canada. He was Métis, and for people who don't know, the Métis are a separate ethnic group from First Nations. They are descendants of both white and indigenous peoples. He was an activist, professor, author, and socialist. Adams had a political relationship with a new socialist group, including being an editorial associate for the magazine. He grew up in a Métis community in Saskatchewan, and he got his PhD at the University of California. But he was influenced by the Black Power movement, had attended a speech by Malcolm X, and was inspired by the national liberation struggles happening at the time. Also, Adams' great-grandfather had helped lead the huge Métis Rebellion in 1885 in Canada. So similar to Mariátegui, Adams introduces a method of how to link race, class, oppression, national liberation, and colonialism, which I haven't found in any other writing. Adams starts from his experience of racism growing up Métis and connects to a broader historical materials framework. He links how dispossession is caused by colonialism and capitalism and the rise of class society. From there, he's able to argue how racism against indigenous peoples is an ideology constructed for material gain for those at the top. He writes, "The racism that Native people encounter today had its origins in the rise of Western imperialism during the 1800s. Businessmen of Europe realizes that they would need a large supply of labor to obtain resources from the new continents. Natives furnished this large supply of labor. The purpose of racism was to reduce the Native people to subhuman level where they could be freely exploited. Racism, therefore, arose from the economic factors in capitalism," end quote. So Adams looks at how Native societies were changed by colonialism, how economic changes starting with the fur trade affected how First Nations organized themselves. The fur trade transformed production of Native people's ways of obtaining food and sustenance, which was communal previously, to producing for exchange for the European market. And ultimately, this formed the basis for their entry into the wage labor system. Canada has a similar, but of course different, history from the US in terms of colonial settlerism and inter-imperial competition for land and resources that stomped over First Nations rights. In Prison of Grass, Adam looks at how an industrial ruling class emerged in Canada out of this colonial settler project and expanded westward. And in the late 1800s, the balance of power shifted in terms of treaty negotiations between the colonizing force and indigenous peoples were, as Adam states, "The white man made lavish promises to induce the Indians to surrender their land. But the reality of these negotiations is that Indians lost their land and lost their rights with very little compensation, except for small plots of land known as reserves." end quote. So Indians had no say in choosing the reserves. They got pennies for acres, but many retained the right to fish and hunt on their historic lands. But the majority of the promises in these treaties were violated, including the right to food and sustenance. And many natives waged armed struggles against these, like indigenous peoples in the United States against the Indian Removal Act and the reservation system. They decided to fight for their independence rather than die from starvation. This was because two economic systems in the Northwest. There was the Hudson Bay Company, which, if people don't know, originally got half of Canada, like, granted by the king. Like, that's crazy. And the new industrial system. So imperialism was expanding as industrialization spread from east to west, especially through the railroads, gobbling up of indigenous lands and resources in the process. And there was resistance to these changing conditions, and amazingly it resulted in this multiracial movement, the rebellion I mentioned that Adams's grandfather participated in the War of 1885. They actually formed an independent government of Native white farmer, settler, and Métis, which is amazing. People should read about this resistance that was multiracial, but it was ultimately overthrown through intense divide and rule by the Canadian government and by them basically producing the newly formed Mounted Police who went after it. So, but I think I bring this up, sorry, it's a lot of history, I know, weaving into this, but I think Adams's analysis of this rebellion influenced his ability to see multiracial solidarity could be achieved by looking at this history. And this was despite him organizing in a period in the 60s and 70s in Canada where the labor movement didn't look to organize natives, nor did they take up the fight against racism and discrimination of natives or Métis in the workplace. Natives were forced into low-paid jobs, paid sub-level wages compared to whites. They were denied pay and often relegated to seasonal work. But the Red Power movement against corrupt Native Reserve governments in Canada in the 60s and 70s, and also against the Bureau of Indian Affairs and tribal councils in the United States, were showing Adams and thousands of Indigenous people that there could be grassroots struggle to take the organization and resources of their communities into their own hands. For instance, Adams describes the retaking of some schools and reserves, where they then were able to use Native labor to rebuild the schools and then democratically run them and open them as public resources to their communities. So ultimately, Adams puts forward a vision in his writing in 1975 about how national liberation struggles alongside broader class struggles could be achieved. And he's worth quoting at length, so bear with me on this one. Quote, "This oppression of the Native people is so deeply rooted in the capitalist system that it cannot be completely eliminated without eliminating capitalism itself. The Indian Métis struggle for self-determination against the ruling class have some potential because of the occupational structure of the Native people. Those Indians and Métis who have jobs are almost exclusively laborers, and very few are of the professional classes or the petite bourgeoisie. Because of racism, we are the most exploited and repressed of all workers. And at the moment, the success of the Native movement depends on its ability to develop a radical thrust upon the strength of its red nationalism. Mobilization of the masses of Indians and Métis is still centered around local community struggles. However, as the struggle widens, social class features will gradually become more prominent, and the movement will turn into a class struggle. Indian and Métis will come to see the different class struggles throughout Canada are not separate, but related," end quote. So I realize there's so much history in terms of the resistance of Indigenous peoples here in the United States and how the nation state came into being that I won't be able to touch on much in this talk. But I just want to point people to Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, to gain a foundation. And I'll just briefly draw out a couple things in her book that are essential for this talk. So Dunbar Ortiz uses a historical materialist method to describe the brutal and bloody process of bringing a new ruling elite and capitalist state into being through genocidal wars waged against indigenous peoples. Native peoples have resisted this process for hundreds of years, and a process that has contributed ultimately, I believe, to the survival and resilience of indigenous peoples today. A vital contribution by Dunbar Ortiz is that she argues that the imperial aims of the United States did not start with the invasions of Cuba and the Philippines in the late 1800s, but instead against indigenous nations after the Revolutionary War. These wars were waged against independent nations. One of the goals of the 13 colonies in gaining independence was overcoming the resistance of the British to further expand territorially and dispossess Indian nations. From the American Revolution through the Civil War, the ruling class gobbled up land and resources driven by land speculation and the spread of slavery. And from the outset, the United States was a settler colonial project, similar to the ones we are familiar with in Palestine, South Africa, and Australia. The settler-indigenous conflict was not something that was natural, Dunbar Ortiz argues. Rather, it was a result of a profit-generating economic system. She says, the notion that settler-indigenous conflict is an inevitable product of cultural differences and misunderstandings, or that violence was committed equally by the colonized and the colonizer, blurs the nature of the historical process. Euro-American colonism, an aspect of the capitalist economic globalization, had from its beginnings a genocidal tendency, end quote. So in her book, Dunbar Ortiz sort of ends by calling for the United States, that we should call for the United States, to follow the treaties they have made, restore sacred sites to nations, self-determination to nations, and pay reparations for historical injustices. She lays out a process that could incorporate the participation of all working people that radically reconfigures our society. Ultimately, I think the development of such a movement that fights for the liberation of indigenous peoples alongside a struggle for working class emancipation as a whole starts with an agreement of some political principles around the rights of nations to self-determination. As socialists, we are fundamentally against borders. We are internationalist, and we understand how workers have more in common with each other all over the world than our rulers of these countries of which we reside. But the argument doesn't end there. As Russian revolutionary Vladimir Lenin argued about 100 years ago, quote, self-determination of nations today hinges on the conduct of socialists and the oppressor nations. A socialist of any of the oppressor nations who does not recognize and does not struggle for the right of oppressed nations to self-determination, including the right to secession, is in reality a chauvinist and not a socialist, end quote. So we have to be unconditionally for the self-determination of oppressed nations, the right of oppressed nations to make their own decisions about their affairs and not be dominated and dictated by powerful nations. In oppressor nations like the United States, the supposed common interests we share are used to justify a state devoted not to ensuring the well-being of all, but to expanding the power and wealth of a small minority that rules U.S. society. In contrast, as Alan Moss importantly detailed in a recent article, a nationalism of the oppressed that opposes and challenges the oppressor can be a step towards challenging the imperialist hierarchy of strong and weak nations and the small elite at the top of that hierarchy. So as Marxists, we have rightfully extended this understanding of national liberation and self-determination to black struggles in the United States. I believe it's time for us also to extend this more fully to Native liberation and First Nation struggles here. So what do struggles of people in indigenous nations open up for us? Inner struggle against U.S. capitalism, racism, and imperialism. Struggles like Standing Rock 2 years ago put into question the founding myths of the United States. We live in a country built on slavery, genocide, dispossession, and exploitation. America was never great. I know you all know this. Marxism is the history of revolution. It's a living, breathing theory, and it has to be based also on our context and our history of the development of capitalism and the struggles against the system. So on this, I'm going to transition to what we can learn from some of the struggles we see emerging today and what we should be fighting for. So 2 years ago, under the banner of Miniwichoni, Waters, Life, and Lakota, over 300 indigenous nations and thousands of non-native people in the United States came together at Standing Rock Indian Reservation, also known as the Hunkpapa Lakota, in North Dakota to stop the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. This was the largest pan-indigenous movement in history. In history. Solidarity stretched from Palestine to the Sami people, who are the indigenous people in Sweden, and back to us. A whole new generation of activists learned the long history of the United States continually breaking treaties with nations, how the U.S. stomps over their self-determination anytime the U.S. government and corporations need access to native lands to extract energy and raw materials, And through this struggle, I think the ecological justice movement is coming to an understanding that treaties must be upheld and extended as demanded by Indigenous nations based on their traditional territories. As our planet burns and our ecosystems are being destroyed for profit and capitalist expansion, it is vital we talk about solutions to the crisis that put Indigenous nations' historic right to their lands, resources, and sacred sites front and center. The struggle at Standing Rock was led by Indigenous people, but we would not have had the victory in delaying the construction for a time if it hadn't been for a broad-based multiracial movement based on solidarity. It's so obvious how our fight is bound up together in these movements. Pipelines poison water that affect millions of people downstream. More burning of fossil fuels, thank you, produce climate change. And this solidarity of Natives, whites, African Americans, Latinos, farmers, veterans, workers, environmentalists have a material basis. Given the current round of attacks on our side by Trump and the ruling class, inequality is increasing on a daily basis. Working people have lost their homes due to foreclosure, people can't afford rent, small farmers are losing their lands, and on. So from the Cowboy Indian Alliance and the Standing Rock today to the Black Hills Alliance in the 1980s to even Wounded Knee 2 of the American Indian Movement, these struggles would not have been possible without a multiracial fight back that connected struggles to the land. Also, at Standing Rock, the very nature of U.S. society came into view for them, for activists. Activists vitally made the political links between the racist state violence, militarism, and imperialism. Standing Rock, I think, also opened up a fuller picture of Native oppression and struggles that go beyond land and treaty rights. I would argue we have the ability to bring the fight against Native oppression and for Native liberation into all the economic and social struggles of today, while keeping the question of land rights central. We can draw on an intersectional approach, first developed by Black socialist feminists. We can't separate the oppression and institutional racism Natives face from the dispossession of Native lands, all of which cause Natives to be disproportionately working class, similar to African Americans. Natives are disproportionately affected by poverty, violence against women, issues of reproductive justice, separation of families through racist adoption practices, police brutality, substandard housing, unequal access to quality education, healthcare, and effects of climate change. Sorry, I always get emotional at one point in my talk. So Natives are overrepresented in low-paying jobs, face racism in the workplace, work in the energy sector. Socialists in these struggles must connect the dots from the land to the workplace. These are working class issues. Struggles for land are also at the core of challenging capitalism's plan to privatize everything. As Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz says, this country is about land, both the possession and who is working on it. So the future that we want and we need to fight for is that land and resources are controlled by the people, and that includes Indigenous land controlled by Indigenous people. Yeah. As socialists, we should understand that we cannot predict how a rupture of the system will break out, how a working class rebellion on a historic scale will combine with an Indigenous liberation movement, Black and women's liberation, and other social struggles to fight to overturn capitalism. We cannot predict what those demands for self-determination will be, but we know a revolution will never be possible in the United States unless we combine all these social forces and break down the divisions imposed upon us. We know that socialists need to be part of these fights today and tomorrow to link up the forces who will fight and organize together to win better conditions for oppressed peoples and the working class, and ultimately to overturn capitalism, which is the root of Native oppression. So on this, I'm just going to give Howard Adams the last word. Quote, the Indian and the Métis movement must focus primarily on the destruction of imperialism, on the process of decolonization. But there is no longer any question of whether that Native struggle should pursue a capitalist or socialist path of development. Liberation can take place only within a true socialist society. End quote.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.